News about Islamic State is everywhere, as well as warnings about its potential threat. When it comes to Central Asia, noise of drum is louder, and not much in the region itself, I believe, but it is coming from Russia, much louder. Today we will discuss how real is the IS threat to Central Asia. In the United States, we have Casey Mitchell, who has recently published a story about a reaction of Russia in Russian media when it comes to threat of IS to the region. In Prague, I have Alisher Siddiq, who is director of Uzbek Service, who, among many other things, is the one who broke the news about the flag of IS hanging in Tashkent recently. And then I have Abu Bakr Siddiqui, author of Pashtun Question and editor of Gandhara website, which closely looks at the Islamic militancy right in outside of the Central Asian border in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. Then Bruce Panier is among us, who looks about almost everything in Central Asia, right?
That's right.
I am Mohammed Tahir from the Turkmen Service of Radio Free Europe. So, Alisher, when we talk about militancy in Central Asia, Alisher, Uzbekistan is the first country, which is your country, which comes into my mind, in everyone's mind. And then Uzbeks are first among number of militants, IS in Syria, in Iraq. Then recently, the case of IS flag hanging in Tashkent, as I just mentioned. Tell us, is the region under threat by IS, Islamic State, or any of its affiliated groups?
We believe that the region has been under threat for many years, and it has a lot of aspects internal. You know, you know that in Uzbekistan, there is Muslims are feeling that they're suppressed, injustice, lack of democracy, lack of freedoms. That creates a lot of problems. Then absolutely harsh crackdown on Muslims inside the country, which let these groups to force out these groups out of the country. That was the whole spin of events when it was the creation of Islamic movement of Uzbekistan under Al-Qaeda and Taliban, then fight against them in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. And there has been this mood for many years that Islamism, you know, Islamic extremism is direct threat, and we've seen some acts, some intrusions into the country. But now what's happening now, it's something new. The new thing is that now Islamic State for some people is more attractive than what's happening inside the country, especially for labor migrants in Russia. We have millions of them in Russia. We don't know how they're being brainwashed in there. This is completely close territory for us. And we see that the majority of militants from Uzbekistan in Syria basically traveled from Russia to Turkey and then into Syria and Iraq. So it's a new phenomenon. But at the same time, the old type of jihadi group, old type of groups like Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, you know, Uzbeks still present in the big numbers in tribal belt in Afghanistan. So these guys are also announcing the open support. So in the what we may expect that the old jihadi group will join the new jihadi group in Syria and create some sort of rotation, so which would lead to some additional, they will get additional power from Syria and Iraq. They will, those who in Syria and Iraq, they will get huge expertise for which these guys gained for many years. They were fleeing drones. They survived lots of attacks. So they know how to make bombs, how to arrange strikes, all these things. So expertise, popularity will join together. There will be rotation, and that will bring some new phenomenon in the whole region.
Bruce, you know, what I'm saying is it's based on our previous conversation about this subject, and you are among the people who say Islamic State is not a threat.
I don't think the Islamic State in the form that it is in Iraq and Syria is so much of a threat. I agree with Alisher 100% that there will be some exchange of expertise. And I also agree that a lot of the people, a lot of the Central Asians that are going to join these groups are radicalized in mosques in Russia, and not so much, obviously, it would be hard to get radicalized in the mosques in Central Asia. They're heavily watched. But I think at the end of the day, there's a couple things to remember here. The Islamic State, for one thing, is making great progress at the moment. One of the things that led to the popularity of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan was the fact that they were ready to take action. you know, that was visible right at the moment, as opposed to saying, you know, we're going to do passive, you know, civil protests and kind of passive resistance to the government, whereas the IMU was much more active. And that's what people wanted to see, was something that was changed, that offered the possibility of, you know, some new form of government or something positive in their lives in the very near future. They didn't want to play the long game. So the Islamic State right now, everyone, you know, they're on TV all the time. There's reports about them all the time. You know, they've been making progress, advancing in Iraq, advancing in Syria. So they look, it looks like they're winners, and they got a game plan that's going to work. So that would be attractive. You know, a lot of people in Central Asia want to get rid of their governments. These guys seem to be able to get the job, something done anyway, as opposed to people who just talk about replacing the government. But I think at the end of the day, the Islamic State is, in its foundations, an Arab-based movement. I mean, these are our people. They have some Wahhabism elements, Salafi elements, things like that. The Central Asian form of Islam is a little bit different, and I don't think it's quite so receptive. We remember that Central Asia, for example, is the birthplace of Sufism. Now, Sufis are heretics in the eyes of the Orthodox Muslims that come out of Saudi Arabia or some of these Arab nations. So I think while people in Central Asia might want to see change in the government and possibly an Islamic form of government, that the form of Islam that the Islamic State is espousing is not compatible with what the Central Asians are used to.
Abu Bakr Siddiqui, you are shaking your hand, probably in agreement with Bruce on something.
I'll say that at this point, Islamic State is not a big threat, and I've read a lot of news reporting and analysis about how IS is making inroads into Afghanistan and Pakistan. A lot of that is, I think, frankly, very alarmist and exaggerated. We know that, Afghanistan, Pakistan is famously the birthplace for Al-Qaeda. It's the place where Al-Qaeda originated, matured into this global terror network, and where they planned and executed from their bases in Afghanistan, Pakistan, plans such as the 9/11, the 7/7 bombings in London. What we have now is one aspect of IS might be appealing to some of the groups, particularly the extreme factions within the Pakistani Taliban or the Pakistani militant factions, and that is the IS determination to take on the Shias and other minorities in greater Middle East. For instance, we have reports about the Pakistani group, anti-Shia group Lashkar-e-Jangvi, cooperating with them. Now, those groups have also been very close to the IMU. In fact, in North Waziristan, they were kind of became one organization or close allies of the IMU. So there is potentially a danger. And we know that in Afghanistan, Pakistan, there is a lot of regrouping happening. There is a big military operation going on in the North Waziristan tribal district, which has been base or the main hideout for all these factions. So this might attract some groups to join ISS, and there are a number of small factions or individuals that have done so, but I don't see as a big strategic shift as of now.
As a moderator, I usually tend not to get involved in the discussion, but here I want to say something. I mean, Bruce, Abu Bakr, both of you have said that there is not much threat, at least, because there is not shared ideology between the Islam that is practiced in Central Asia and IS. But what I observe is there are lots of other elements in Central Asia, like poverty, like being tired of the way they are being ruled, the human rights, the social problems that exist in the Central Asian countries, and they cannot find their way out of that. So IS, as a strong militant, although they offer something at least to remove their government or take them out from that situation, the situation that they are facing today. There are lots of other social elements which could be attractive for Central Asian people to join their forces with IS militants. Here I want to bring Casey Mitchell in. Casey, you were in Central Asia most recently as part of your assignment in Bishkek. What is the feeling in that part of the world you've been to about a group like IS or the ideology that they carry in that part of the world?
Well, Mohammed, I think you make a fantastic point just now. Even though the ideologies perhaps are not aligned, there exist other factors that can drive individuals, groups, families, toward a group like Islamic State. At the same time, I guess I just want to take a step back just for a second and say that Bruce's and Abu Bakr's opinion is that it's Islamic State is not currently a threat to the region. I would tend to side with that. I don't see them playing any kind of tactical or strategic moves in the region anytime soon whatsoever. And that draws from a whole host of different reasons that we've already discussed. But, Muhammad, just to get back to your question, the factor that can drive those individuals to join a group like Islamic State exist and, in a certain sense, are only being exacerbated. And speaking especially about Kyrgyzstan, where I had my most recent assignment, the infrastructure of the country, the economic, the resource infrastructure of Kyrgyzstan is not moving in the right direction, whether it is on energy policy or education policy, whether it is religious policy, especially. There are currently discussions in Kyrgyzstan about increasing state involvement in mosques, in religious education. That is the, it would seem, kind of modus operandi for Bishkek right now for dealing with those elements that would be otherwise inclined to be sympathetic to Islamic State. Obviously, in Kyrgyzstan, the south is tends to be more orthodox, more devout, and from what I've been able to gather over the last 5, 6, 7 years, and I can only speak for myself over the last year or so, but again, from what I gather from discussions of the last 5, 6, 7 years, the outward display of Islamic faith, of orthodoxy, that's not to say sympathy for anything pertaining to Islamic State or the ideologies therein, but the outward displays of faith have increased significantly, especially around Osh and Jalalabad as well. So, Muhammad, just to get back to your question, the factors very much exist in the region that could drive individuals, groups, families toward Islamic State. And unfortunately, those factors are only being exacerbated through current policy. And that's not simply in Kyrgyzstan, but that extends to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and Turkmenistan.
I think Alisher could give more perspective on that subject. I mean, IS flag being hanged in Tashkent. We recently had another report from Tajikistan, from a village which became actually a recruiting center for IS in Tajikistan. What are these signs? How to read them?
You know, it could be some flash mob, some stupid game, but it really, really scared local security services. They were searching for persons, still searching. We got another report. We could not confirm that this exact flag was hanged. Another region of Tashkent, it looks like some silly, but some teenagers type of flash mobs, which may not be, you know, that the region or in Tashkent you have real supporters, real people ready to take and go there. I would not see any immediate threat, like now, tomorrow, today, but we're dealing with the long, with the ideology which survived centuries. The trajectory of that is longer than we may even understand it. You know, we thought IMU is dead, but the ideology is here. Now we have another new group. You have Tahrir el-Daj dead, but you have another new leader coming now. So we're dealing with the ideology. I believe that the threat is rather ideological, where we go as a region. If IS would not commit all these atrocities, all these bad crimes, I mean, like killing, you know, beheading, I would even see they would have even more supporters. But they started doing that and just at the very early of their terrorist carriers. If they would hold on that, I mean, they would even have even more supporters. You know, even IMU people, you know, with whom we talk. They say the same thing. And I was doing the other day live show to discuss IS. You will be amazed how many people calling live and express their sympathy to this group. I thought that we got over the sympathy part and we have to discuss the part where we how to encounter them and stuff. But the whole show was disaster because we had to encounter our listeners calling from United States. You know, this is like, means that the ideology, the attractiveness of this thing goes beyond even the region with the worst human rights abuses, but it's also sits in the hearts of people living in the democratic states, and you would always want to ask them why do you sit there and don't go into Syria and Iraq. I mean, this is like I wouldn't be so sure about ideological differences. In the end, this is one religion. And they can find ways of interaction, and that's exactly what they're doing at this point.
Yes, Abu Bakr, you jump in, please. Yeah.
Well, I think ISIS, at least, is, apart from the fact that the existence of IS or the growth of IS will not serve the strategic interest of any states in South Central Asia, including Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and all Central Asian stands. They will, I don't see, like, for example, in the case of Afghan Taliban, Pakistan had major strategic interests. So they tolerated or helped in the creation and then the growth of the Taliban. The same can be true for other Arab jihadis. Al-Qaeda is one manifestation of that. But, I mean, the IS Khilafat is in direct clash with the Islamic Khilafat, the Mullah Muhammad Umar, the Taliban leader, announced a long time ago. The other thing we need to understand is that I don't think that Islam is one ideology. There are many sects, there are subsects. IS is one extreme, harsh sect that I think most practicing Muslims do not agree with or do not see any reason to follow. I'll give you an example. I mean, the Saudis, who are supposed to be the bastion of Salafism, Wahhabism, they are not only fighting against part of this coalition that is fighting the IS in Iraq and Syria, but they have come out and have done some very good religious advocacy work. For example, in the khutbah in the Hajj, the most important Islamic annual ritual, the Imam of Kaaba specifically condemned them. Then they launched a campaign both in the Arab media and also in the Western media, where Saudi scholars wrote about the Islamic State and compared them to Khawarij, which are considered heretics in early Islam. 1400 years ago, Khawarij was a faction that killed two of the four pious Muslim caliphs. So I don't see that they will have any great attraction to the larger Muslim population in this region, but also specifically to the diehard militants, because these militants have organizations, they have their own aims, and we should also not forget that most of the Arab jihadists still operating from South Asia, particularly Pakistan, they recently formed something called the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic subcontinent. Zawahiri announced it, and Zawahiri and Al-Qaeda are clearly opposed to Islamic State. They, even in their view, Islamic State is a kind of a heretic faction.
I read that announcement. I thought, which is kind of a political clash between these two major groups, Abu Bakr or Bruce, you might jump into this question. I mean, then what is a driving factor behind the sympathy of ordinary people that Alisher was just mentioning? Then where is this coming from then?
No, I mean, I think we've been hitting at this during the conversation already. There is huge injustice in Central Asia. There's no doubt about it. You know, people see the elites and their families living these lives that are practically beyond their imaginations. They're tired of it. So the appeal of a group like the Islamic State is that they present the potential to get rid of this corrupt and decaying system that's in Central Asia. I think if a group wasn't, it need not even be Islamic. If you could find a strong enough power that would say, we're going to come and get rid of your government and then we'll leave, most people would get behind that 100%. And I think that's kind of where the Islamic State is now. Like I said, they're doers, not talkers. And everyone sees that's possible. They represent a totally different tomorrow or next week for a lot of these people out there. The problem comes once they've conquered the territory. Let's say that happens. Mm-hmm. Now what happens? You know, do the women all put burqas on and stay inside all the time? They're not used to that. What about the nomadic, the people with nomadic heritage, like the Kazakhs and Kyrgyz, whose women have never been veiled or something like that? This isn't part of their Islam. What about the Sufi masters that have mazars, the tombs and stuff? A group like the Islamic State would dig that up and raise those things, and we've seen them blowing up revered mosques from the past based on some of these militants' perception that something about that was not Orthodox Islam as they understand it. In the end, they're destroyers, not builders. There's no doubt about it. And I think that's where they would run into a problem. Would the people in Central Asia like to see him come and run Karimov out of office or Rahman or something? Absolutely. Would they want them to stay the next day? Probably not.
I know Abu Bakr and Alisher, both of you want to say something in this subject. Let's go with Abu Bakr.
I'll just make a very quick observation here. If you look at all the foreign fighters that have joined the Islamic State, it's very interesting but very revealing. I think from UK in particular, there are thousands of people who have joined the Islamic State, according to the media reports that we have. But compared to a country of Pakistan, where it is supposed to be a very religious society, and it has been in the midst of a lot of insurgencies, a lot of militant groups operate from there, only 330 people have joined the IS so far. Yes, I agree with Bruce's observation that to the disgruntled people of Central Asia, this might be a very appealing thing. But for the Islamic State, actually, to provide that kind of a base to the Central Asian militants and join them just like they had joined the Taliban in the 1990s and later on in Pakistan and Afghanistan, that is, I still think, is a very major challenge.
Yes, Alisher?
Yeah, two things. One of these people in Uzbekistan, for example, are seeing, what is the frustration? It's deeper than we think. They are in Russia. They believe they're working for kafirs, for those, they believe they're doing the wrong job in the wrong place for wrong people. They see hundreds, thousands of prostitutes from Uzbekistan working in that area. Back in Uzbekistan, they see forced labor, they see injustice, people it's a big thing what they see as a frustration. And for them, IS is not the worst alternative, though it is from another trash bin. But there's no alternative for the democracy, for liberal ideas, because they, at the same time, they're watching Russian television here and there, which is not also giving a new alternative for the development. There's no alternative, and the alternative will be always, as I'm sorry to say that, from the trash bin. It will be either dictatorship, authoritarianism, or Islamism. That is the harshest and hardest part to tackle these groups in the long term.
Alisha, it's interesting that you mentioned the Russian aspect here. Casey, you had a very nice piece a few days ago in Diplomat, analyzing what the Russian media is saying about the threat of IS to Central Asia. How to understand the drumbeat that's coming from Moscow in this subject?
Well, I believe it was Alisher who a few minutes ago made a fantastic point that if Islamic State had not come out at the very beginning with these massacres, with these beheadings, they would have had far more appeal to not just Central Asian individuals or groups, but worldwide as well. And I think that's a fantastic point to remember. Unfortunately, on the flip side, those videos, those instances have allowed Moscow to capitalize. And they have allowed the media, as well as think tank individuals, and certain security officials to portray Islamic State as this massive boogeyman out there that is hiding in every shadow, that is behind every doorway, that is coming for every Central Asian state and eventually Russia. And at this point, I just want to say that this is by no means limited to Russia. I'm now back in the United States, and I see it playing out here as well. You have politicians who are talking about Islamic State fighters swimming across the Rio Grande from Mexico to Texas to invade the United States. I don't know where they get this material from, but that's what they actually believe. But Moscow is very much in the same vein. And I'll just read a brief quote that my article is based on. It was an interview with Yevgeny Sechenovsky, who is the president of the Russian Institute for Middle East Studies. And he had a few interesting things to say. One, he said that up to 5,000 Central Asian militants could be fighting with Islamic State. I have no idea where he gets this number from. As RFERL just reported the other day, the numbers don't look like it could be even more than 1,000 coming from Central Asia. But he also said that the officials and security structures in Central Asia and all Central Asian states need to have, and I quote, absolute control of religious life because all of Central Asia is within the reach of Islamic State. So what he's offering is something close to carte blanche for security officials in Central Asia to crack down that much further, to offer that much further restriction, repression, monitoring, observation of individuals and groups, of mosques, of educational centers, that would, in their estimation, send fighters to Islamic State. But at the same time, it's just that much further reason to crack down on any kind of opposition structures. And we've seen that come to play already over the last week with in Tajikistan, with the Group 24 getting the extremist designation. I have no doubt that that will continue for the foreseeable future. I'm not sure what would slow that, and the rhetoric coming out of Moscow will only support that.
Yes, Bruce.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that a little bit, too, that whether it's an example of this, some of the Central Asian leaders taking advantage of this and using it to their own benefit, or whether they truly buying into it, they have both President Karimov and his Independence Day address, and President Rahmon of Tajikistan and his Independence Day address did bring up the subject of the Islamic State. All of a sudden, now we know that Karimov, his address happened a few days after this black flag was hanging in Uzbekistan. But again, Rahmon returned to this point at the CIS, recent CIS summit, where he said that the CIS needs a common strategy to confront the Islamic State. So Moscow's warnings seem to be at least falling on their ears fairly heavily. And like I said, what their motivation is for bringing this up, whether they really believe that that is a threat or whether they want to use this for their own own benefit somewhere down the line. The fact is that this is what they get out in a national address and tell the people. They don't dwell on it too much, but they have brought it up.
And very shortly, I'm sorry, how did this regime can fight these ISIS and all this corruption and everything? That and people, you know, analysts come, there's only one solution. You know, all these regimes should commit suicides, you know, and that is the fight, the biggest fight for against everything, like in the extremism or corruption locally. On the ideology front, I know I'll bring our discussion back to, you know, to the beginning, but we're talking to moderates, we're talking to Hizb ut-Tahrir who fight for the same caliphate, but from the with political means. Even their rhetoric is changing, because they say, what if this already in place? I mean, what we are fighting for politically, and what is the final destination is there? Why would we need to go all this political way to come to this, since these guys already there, you know? So my fear is that moderates and other political Muslim community will start thinking this direction, that the only tool in our debates against ISIS is their atrocities. So the only thing that we can always refer to, why do you kill people? I mean, Islam says don't kill people, and you're killing people. Why, if these guys will stop killing people, and if, for example, and these moderates will start joining this ideological trend? So that is, I think, long term, but as at this point, only ideological threat.
Right. I think, Bruce, you were mentioning that the fact that Central Asian leaders have been using and are using these threat of terrorism as an excuse to crack down further. It's not a new thing, right? I mean, they have been doing that in the past.
When the first bombs went off in Tashkent in February 1999, everyone understood that it couldn't have been more than a dozen or two dozen people that were responsible. But thousands of Muslims in Uzbekistan were arrested after that, and it helped spur recruitment for the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, who had not even appeared in Central Asia prior to these bombings, and in fact wouldn't make an appearance for several months after that, at least as that group. And there was stories of thousands of Muslims fleeing Uzbekistan and ending up in the mountains of Tajikistan and northern Afghanistan. And then August 1999 comes around, and here they all come out of the hills. And even the Tajik authorities understood at the time that there had been a group of Uzbeks that were led by Juma Namangani and Tahrir Yoldash, and they had been part of the Islamic wing of the Tajik opposition during the time, but that more people had joined them between February 1999 and the start of August 1999, which was the time that the Tajik opposition was supposed to totally complete their disarmament. So Tajik authorities were aware of that. Uzbek authorities were aware that they had all gone there too, and were actually trying, according to former Ambassador Paul Byrne of the British Embassy in Tajikistan, that the Uzbek government had been in negotiations with them trying to get them to come down and surrender. It didn't work, obviously, but so people were aware that they were there and that their numbers were growing at the same time after this crackdown. Like I said, they sadly, it's not even just the Uzbek reaction anymore, but certainly Uzbekistan tends to swat a fly with a sledgehammer all the time. They don't want anything to get through at all.
You're saying that this crackdown actually backlashed, right? I mean,
it has every time.
What does then Moscow want here? I mean, why this drumbeat? I mean, what's this noise about?
Well, this is a good question. Do they want to create instability, or do they really perceive this as a legitimate threat? Ultimately, I think, I don't know, maybe someone will want to argue with me, but we know that the Chinese have a lot of economic influence in Central Asia, but it's always been my position that when it comes to security, everyone in Central Asia figures the only one that's going to help them is Russia if things go bad. Mm. And so I suppose if you wanted to do conspiracy theories, you could argue that it's in Russian interest to create instability that would prompt Central Asian leaders to invite them back into the region in force.
Is that your feeling here in general? I mean, if you wish to comment on this?
Yeah, if I could just jump in off of Bruce's point very quick. I mean, I think that's a fantastic question. That's what Russia's ultimate position or strategy in the region may be, especially from a security perspective. And there's a quote from a few weeks ago from the head of the CSTO, Nikolai Babiulin, who said that they have been observing an attempt to create some sort of underground extremist state in Central Asia. And that wasn't necessarily directly about IS, though it was in the midst of the rhetoric coming from Moscow about the region. Moscow's security card in Central Asia is still far and away far stronger than anything any other external actor can offer. And as we've seen recently, Moscow does not have any qualms about extending its security reach in its quote-unquote near abroad. And this also entails the comments from President Putin a few weeks ago about potential uncertainty following the succession of President Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan. And that obviously can extend to uncertainty in Kyrgyzstan, uncertainty in Tajikistan, and if you want to include Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan in there as well, you can. It's a fantastic question. What this drumbeat, what this rhetoric is hoping to gain, yes, on the one hand, it is increased allowance for restriction, repression, moves against Muslims or education centers or mosques. But on the other hand, what is the end goal with that? Is it repression for repression's sake, or is there something more?
Alisher, you wanted to say something on that?
I don't think that Russia, deeply understands what's going on, because it's basically drawn into its own internal and problems with the West, Ukraine, and they have been very, very busy with that, with this part of the world. I don't think they have pondering deeply on what to do with the ISIS at this point. But I just see that this is a Russian's fault that this ISIS grown up so fast and so big, because they could convince Obama not to take action against Assad when it had to be taken in the beginning. Then the group gained and more power, and it turned into disaster. If you remember, it's just one reading of the situation. Russia is behind this group from some point of view. If they would not wait for so long to take down Assad regime, they wouldn't have this powerful group at this point, you know, at that in that capacity. But what to do with that and whether to stir the security situation in Central Asia, I don't think that Russia terribly interested in that, because it will come to the threshold soon. If you start something in Uzbekistan, for example, these countries, when these guys go out of control, then it's not, you cannot provide the control crisis type of in this area.
Well, and I would just mention, though, that it doesn't have to be the reality of a security threat, you know, actually starting on the ground. It's more the perception. And for what it's worth, and there's many reasons besides the Islamic State, but again, going back to the CIS summit, they managed to get all the Central Asian presidents to come, and that doesn't happen very often. So the fact that all of them were willing to go, now, was that a little bit Ukraine? Probably yes. Was that a little bit Islamic State? Probably yes also. So, there's kind of a shift here, and certainly everyone in Central Asia, the leadership anyway, is at least willing to listen to Russia and keep them close just in case.
Yeah. Abu Bakr?
Well, I think part of the problem in Central Asia is also societal, because this is, I mean, in many ways, it's a unique Muslim society that was under Muslim societies that were under communism for a very, very long time. I mean, if you go to some village in Tajikistan and look at the religious practices, and then you just move across the border in Afghanistan, there is a great difference. You are in two completely different worlds in so many ways. And the same, this makes, I think, Central Asian states very vulnerable, but what is also very worrying for me personally, in my own experience, is that I think, like Central Asia, Asians, governments, or some of the observers, they get carried away by threats that are more hypothetical. But the real threat to Central Asia, as I see it, because Central Asia is predominantly Sunni Muslim societies, comes from Afghanistan and Pakistan. And there has to be, IMU has been very consciously trying to build bases in northern Afghanistan so it can project back into Central Asia for many years now. And I think that is the real threat. I mean, nobody can quantify it exactly. I've heard, people who, until a couple of years ago, people who were kind of talking to Russian officials, they were saying that there are a few hundred people. But when you actually talk to people in Pakistani tribal areas and in Pakistan, Afghanistan, they'll tell you that the IMU numbers were in thousands, not in hundreds. In other way, in historical terms, I think Central Asia eventually be move much closer to integrate with South Asia compared to with former Soviet Union.
Right. We could continue discussing about this subject. So,
yeah, you're right. We could go on for hours.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And Casey from United States here, Ali Sher Abu Bakr, and Bruce Panier here in Prague. Thank you very much. It has been, as always, really a fantastic discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.